science enthusiasts. I'm your host, Jason Zukoski. I'm a high school chemistry teacher, but you probably know our dogs, Bunsen and Beaker. They're the science dogs on social media. This show takes what's best from their account, the curiosity and fun found there, and swirls it into podcast form. Every week, we're going to take some deep dive into an area of science and look at the research that's going on with our pets. We'll also have an expert guest who will enthrall you with their area of knowledge. This is the Science Podcast. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Science Podcast. We hope you're happy and healthy out there. The wildfire smoke cleared a bit, so we've been out and about with the dogs and enjoying the summer, doing some paddleboarding and doing some short hikes and getting ready for a really epic adventure that we're taking out to Vancouver Island in a couple weeks. On the Science Podcast this week in science news, we're going to take a look at the earthquakes or the Marsquakes, the Marsquakes that happened on Mars. In pet science, we're going to look at the article that Timothy Copfield tagged us with. It's the article about pet diets. And our expert guest is a nuclear engineer, Emery Colvin. We get to talk about splitting atoms and Dungeons and Dragons. Hey dogs, did you hear that the nuclear engineer was mandated to take anger management courses? Yeah, it's to lower the likelihood of meltdowns. Okay, on with the show. Because there's no time like science time. This week in science news, we're back in space. A lot of amazing science communicators on Twitter, over the last couple weeks, were talking about these Mars quakes. And I thought we should just chat about Mars quakes. For those of you maybe not in the know about all things space, and I love space, but I'm not tuned into what NASA's discovering. Data from NASA's InSight lander picked up these Mars quakes and also hinted at about some really cool things about the Martian geography of the Martian structure of the planet. The analysis of these seismic waves was picked up by, as I said, NASA's InSight lander. The InSight lander has been on Mars since 2018, and after that time started to pick up a whole bunch of data. Now, it takes a long time to take that data, analyze it, figure out what it means, and then communicate it. So while the data's been around since 2018, science communicators and journals and everything are just getting their talons into this interesting story. Now, the seismically active region was about 1,000 kilometers away from where the lander is, and the Mars quakes had a magnitude of about 3 to 4. It was, you know, it was significant. One of the interesting things is that the seismologists that looked at the different kind of seismic waves that occurred from a bunch of different of these Mars quakes, the two different waves produced are pressure waves and shear waves. Now, shear waves can't get through a liquid. They move really slow and they travel side to side like a snake, rather than like a slinky being pushed and pulled back together again, like pressure waves do. I teach about earthquakes and science in one class that I teach in, and it's pretty basic. So like the pressure waves I call P waves, and they're usually kind of the first waves that get to you. And shear waves I call S waves. So there might be some terminology that's a little different that you grew up with. Of those 11 Mars quakes that InSight picked up, a bunch of them had vibrations that included shear waves strong enough to stand out from the background. The conclusion is the shear waves that the InSight thing picked up, the InSight lander picked up, had to have been reflected off of a liquid core rather than entering a solid core and being partially absorbed. Now, this is kind of fascinating. I had thought that Mars didn't have a liquid core, but this is evidence that it does. And they can actually do some really cool calculations based on the shear waves and the pressure waves, based on the time that they arrive at InSight, because they travel different speeds. And it suggests that Mars has a core that's 3,660 kilometers in diameter. Now, that's a little bit more than half the diameter of the entire planet. That's way bigger than what they thought before. One of the interesting things also that this helps show is that they were confused why they weren't getting more data to InSight, and it's because the core is so big, it's probably blocking a lot of seismic waves from other parts of the planet. This means that Mars is probably more seismically active than even the landers sensors can detect and what we thought previously. Now, one of the things that this kind of helps conclude is that it has a liquid core, but what we don't know is that if it has a liquid core and a solid core like Earth, right? Earth has a liquid core and then a solid core, and that's a mystery right now. But the evidence from the InSight lander is that Mars at least has a liquid core. And one of the quotes that from one of the co-authors, Amir Khan, he's a geophysicist, said is that like the data is there, we just have to find it. If you're wondering, Earth's core is about 3,485 kilometers across. So that means the Mars core is bigger than the Earth core. I found delving into this really fascinating. I saw a couple science communicators who were on TikTok doing really amazing videos about it. And I was like, well, they do a good job with the video because podcast is audio, I had to go more into the study about it to figure out what was going on. Mars quakes. Molten core on another planet. Who would have thought? That's science news for this week. This week in Pet Science. So a fellow science communicator, Timothy Caulfield, he's in Alberta. He was actually a guest on the Science Podcast. He tweeted out an article and tagged us about pet diets. And it's all about grain-free diets. And it touches a nerve with a lot of pet owners because we want what's best for our pets. And the amount of, I guess, like misinformation or real information or true information or whatever nutritional information about what to feed pets is a really gray area where people say, well, this is what's right for my pet. So that's what I'm going to do. And sometimes the science doesn't really hold up on that regard. What this brand new study is about is grain-free diets. The long and short of it is the study that was published in the Journal of Feline Medicine and Surgery is that it's a marketing term rather than a health term. So far in all of the scientific data, there is nothing that shows that grain-free diets have any health benefits for dogs or cats more than traditional diets. What was the methodology of the study? The team gathered ingredients and basic nutritional information on 77 dry cat diets and 42 diets that contained grains and 35 diets that were grain-free. They found them online by retailers. Then they broke down the ingredient category by category and compared the nutrients between the two categories. So here are just some of the interesting things they found. The average grain-free diet had a lower amount of carbohydrates than the average diet that contained grains, but some of the grain-free diets were similar or even higher in carbohydrates to diets with grains. The animal protein in both grain-free and grain-containing were pretty much the same, and the most common one was chicken, poultry. In grain-free diets, the most common carbohydrate or plant-based ingredients were peas, cranberries, potatoes, and carrots. The most common plant-based ingredient in the ones that contain grains were rice, flax, cranberries, and oats. Some of the unusual ingredients found were things like lettuce and celery, avocado, artichoke, papaya, and zucchini. There were more common exotic meats in grain-free diets like bison and rabbit. The conclusion also stated that all dry cat food diets contain carbohydrates of one form or another. Grain-free diets swapped grains for things like peas and potatoes, and even something like tapioca. And these ingredients are no more quote-unquote natural or healthy for your cat than grains. One of the most common allergies in animals isn't grain, it's the animal protein. So switching to grain-free, if you want to get away from, say, chicken or poultry is common across the board in both types. Another thing that I found interesting is that a lot of the diets contained cranberries, like almost 50% of all of the diets contain cranberries. And when you delve into it, it's potentially good for your pet's urinary tract. However, there's zero studies to show that that's a benefit, and there's very little data in dogs. The dog data is there, but very weakly. Cranberry diets may protect against one very specific type of bacteria that could cause infection. In the grain-free ones, there is a lot of ingredients that, well, not grain, there's no evidence that they would improve your pet's health, nor is there evidence that they would ever eat these in nature as well. That's a common thing that is advertised, is that a grain-free product is more natural based on what a cat would eat in nature. Well, in the grain-free cat foods, there are things like avocados and artichokes and blackberries. So again, like, those are pretty rare and exotic type materials, and they're really just making the cat food more expensive. So in the end, I'm not a vet. I have zero vet training. I only know what the vet tells me, and I only do what the vet usually tells, and we try our best. I take the vet's recommendations. When we go to the vet, we're like, is there a doctor? I'm like, doctor, tell me how we can make our pets healthier. So obviously, if you're listening to me on the podcast and you're like, my pets do great on grain-free, or my vet recommended grain-free, okay, that's great. I'm not going to counteract a doctor's advice. But just to be aware, that's what the newest study on grain-free diets concluded. They analyzed what was in them, and it's puzzling and potentially no different health-wise for your cat, health-wise for your pet. Interesting, hey? Obviously, just ask your vet, see what they say. I'm going to ask my vet and see what they say. That's Pet Science for this week. Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to the Science Podcast this week. The Science Podcast is always going to be free to download, but if you want to support the show, there's a couple things you can do. The first one is sign up on our Patreon page, patreon.com/BunsenBurner. There's multiple tiers of support. We have a ton of fun with the patron group. You get to be on the podcast. You get postcards from Bunsen and Beaker. You get swag. You get early pictures. You get a whole bunch of awesome stuff. So check it out. The lowest tier is only $5 a month. The other way you could support the show is checking out our merch shop. Our merch shop is hilarious. It's got all of these adorable cartoons of Bunsen and Beaker. We keep producing more. I just want to thank the people that have supported the show that way. We're really, really proud of our merch shop because the merch, the clothes, is really high quality. The colors are vibrant, and we come up with some really fun designs all the time. So check it out. That's at BunsenBurnerBMD.com. Thanks, everybody. On to the interview. It's time for Ask an Expert on the Science Podcast, and I am super thrilled to have Emery Colvin, who is a nuclear engineer, on the line with me today. How are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you?
I'm good. Little hot. We were just talking about the weather. This podcast is going to be banked, so I'm not sure when it's going to come out, but you are even hotter than Alberta right now.
Yeah, I'm in Oregon, and it has been very hot in Oregon.
Oh, man. We're just not used to this kind of heat in Alberta, Canada. Like, when it gets a little bit warm, everybody starts complaining, and some people are like, guys, you know how hot, cold it gets in the winter? Like, just deal with it. So,
yeah.
Are you from Oregon? Or are you there for school?
I'm not. Yeah, I'm here for school. I grew up in Atlanta. So I'm used to warm weather, but I'm also used to having air conditioning with it.
I was going to say, yeah, like, Atlanta's hotter than Oregon. It's like further
yes,
south.
Yes, but everything is air conditioned.
Gotcha. Yeah. You might get some Georgia's on. It's on the coast, right? You might get some breeze too. I don't know.
Atlanta's pretty far inland. But
I was going to say it's like 2 or 3 hours inland. Okay, yeah. I was wrong about that. That's why I don't teach geography. I teach chemistry. How's you and your family and friends doing with coronavirus? Is everything going okay with that?
I think I've had it the worst of everybody. So I have an autoimmune condition, which means that I'm in that region of. They're like, well, we recommend you get the vaccine, but we also don't know if it will work at all for you. And then I also had the unfortunate, like, autoimmune response to the vaccine. So I've been.
Oh, so you got the shot?
Yeah, I did. Like, that was never a question for me personally. Okay. I'm like, wasn't going to risk it. Even if it's not as effective, it might be something. Mm-hmm. But it did cause, like, an autoimmune response. So, you know, my body was like, all right. The immune system's all revved up to go, and it just kept going on to the things it's not supposed to go after.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. That's why, you know, I talk to my students all the time, and that's the main thing about, you're not necessarily, like, somebody who doesn't have an autoimmune disease, you're not getting vaccinated if you're fairly healthy to protect yourself, especially if you're young from COVID.
you're getting that vaccine to protect other people. So we stop the spread. So anyways, I hope you stay safe.
Yeah, no, I'm being careful about it. And, you know, like I said, it was never a question for me. It's like, even if I had a bad response or something, it was still worth it for whatever level of protection I can get.
Gotcha. Gotcha. All right. So let's talk a little bit about you in science. Emery, what are you trained in and where are you in your career in science right now?
So I got my master's degree several years ago. I kind of bounced through a few different jobs and ended up in a teaching position for a while. And I found that I really like teaching. But with a master's degree, at least in the US, it's hard to find like a full-time teaching position. It tends to be mostly like adjunct.
Oh, we're talking like post-secondary, like colleges and universities. Okay, yeah. Okay, gotcha. Yep.
So I decided to go back to school to get my PhD.
So
going back at a much later date for the rest of my schooling.
What was your, I apologize, what was your master's in?
It's all nuclear engineering.
Oh, no, all nuclear engineering. Okay, yeah. Cool. So, man, that's, okay, so not, I don't know anybody who is in anywhere near a nuclear engineer. When you were young, why did you pursue that as something in post-secondary after high school?
I went in undecided engineering, and it was a small program. And I was like, well, I like this, you know, I like this stuff in physics. And I like engineering because it tends to be a little bit more like hands-on and practical. Mm. So and like I said, it was a small program, so you get to actually spend a lot more time like one-on-one with professors.
Gotcha.
And there tends to be a lot of jobs because there's a lot of variety of what you can do with nuclear, well beyond what people traditionally would think of.
Oh, well, we might have to get into that. Yeah, because like where I am in the world, we are just starting to talk about anything nuclear right now. but I know in Eastern Canada, they do have nuclear stuff. So you like the engineering aspect, you like the schematics. Were you big on the schematics when you were growing up, like the plans and the how things operate kind of thing?
Not so much that, more the like, can I put this together and make it do something?
Oh, cool. Well, see, I liked that when I was growing up, like the Meccano and the Lego and all that kind of stuff. But see, that high level math just like kicked my butt. So that's why I'm in chemistry instead of physics.
Yeah. Well, and like you can tell, like kind of my sister and I diverged at a point and she went into architecture.
Oh, well, so that's like, that's important though.
Yeah. No, it's very important.
Yeah. Little less math, a little more schematics.
Yeah. She's better at drawing things.
Man, what you're in school for and what you're going to get a PhD in. And we need both of those professions. That's awesome.
Yeah. So. My parents were very, very like enthusiastic and supportive of us like going on. Like we were going to go to college because my dad, you know, went to like, he got his education through the Navy as enlisted. And my mom went to a tech college and learned programming. But like, we were going to go get like a 4-year degree.
No choice.
Yeah. It was never even an option.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you did that because you're here talking to me. So in nuclear engineering, what have you worked on? What are you working on right now? Is there some things we should know about the topic that you're kind of an expert on at this point?
Yeah, I mean, so like with nuclear, there's so much weird things that nobody thinks about with nuclear. Like you've got, you know, usually people will think of like power, weapons, and sometimes medicine. So, you know, there's a whole like nuclear medicine side of things. But like even beyond all of that, like if you're doing a lot of biology research, uses like lots of little isotopes that you can use to track things. And, you know, someone has to make those. They have to, you know, package them up and ship them and keep track of them and then dispose of them. So you've got like that whole supply chain going. You have things like testing. A lot of non-destructive testing will use nuclear stuff. Like we have a facility here that can check like welds on like aircraft.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I'm familiar with that. I actually did a in between teaching contracts when I was trying to provide for my family when I was a young man. I worked in the oil patch here in Alberta. And, when we were putting pipe in the ground, they were like radioactively checking it for I forget the exact word. cracks or whatever.
Yeah.
The integrity. There we go. They were checking the integrity of the pipes.
Yeah, they actually, when I was still, I think, an undergrad, they set all of our detectors off in the building when they were building a new parking deck. Because they were testing the concrete.
And was everybody freaking out when everybody's like, well, if you're in?
the alarm went off, and it was like a legacy alarm that was still there from when the campus had had a reactor at Georgia Tech, which was all gone. Like, the reactor had been long gone. And we're like, there's nothing we have on campus powerful enough to set this off. What is going on?
Oh, man. Were some people are like, apocalypse? Or were they not?
No, it was more like, this can't be a real thing. We just need to find out what's wrong with it.
It's a false alarm.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay. And is that what you're working on right now? Can you tell us what you're working on? Or is it kind of hush-hush?
No. My research, like my dissertation research, I'm looking at like radioisotope production. And I came into that through looking at plutonium production for NASA missions. So the rovers, New Horizons, those are all powered by nuclear batteries.
Yep.
And so we have to be able to make that plutonium. And we used to make it as part of like the weapons process, and it was just like a trash product from the weapons process. And we don't have that anymore. And then we bought from the Russians for a while, and we don't do that anymore. So now we've got to come up with our own supply for it.
I have so many questions. I have so many questions.
Yeah.
Okay. So what's step one? Where do you get plutonium from? Where does it come from?
So most of the way, like the way everybody's looking at it now is you take neptunium-237, and I don't entirely remember where that supply process comes from. We've got a lot of that sitting around. And you irradiate it. You stick it in a reactor and you just cook it for a while.
No way. You put it like right next to in a nuclear power plant.
Not a power plant.
Oh, okay. All right.
So there's kind of two broad categories of reactors. Like, you'll have a nuclear power plant and you'll have a research reactor. A research reactor is designed to have lots of nooks and crannies where you can put things.
To do this exact process.
Yeah.
So it just cooks for a bit and it turns into plutonium.
Yeah. I mean, among other things. And like, you know, where you put it will depend on if you get what you're looking for. But yeah. And
is that process dangerous? Like, have you had to handle that in your research? Like, you'd have to get into like a hazmat suit or lead?
No, you wouldn't need it wouldn't be a hazmat suit. It would be, usually you handle everything very remotely. So I do work with our research reactor here on campus.
Okay.
We don't do anything with plutonium because they're like the level of extra scrutiny for plutonium is unbelievable.
They're worried about somebody doing something with it, right?
Right,
like,
right.
Nefarious, something evil.
Yeah, anything that's like uranium or plutonium, specifically, like those two are just a nightmare. As far as regulations go, but like with anything else, it depends. Basically, like you'll pull it out cautiously, you know, held far away from the body, and you'll have someone else checking to see like what kind of radiation dose is coming off of a sample. And then based on that, you might let something sit for a little while until like the really, really active stuff dies off a little bit. Sometimes we'll have specialized casks that, you know, you just pull it out and directly into a cask that you then close up immediately.
Right.
So it just kind of depends on what you're working with as to how dangerous it is. But most stuff you wouldn't ever need a hazmat suit because that's mostly going, like a hazmat suit isn't going to stop radiation.
Right. I'm sorry. That's biological. I know very little about this, and most of it's from like Back to the Future to run the DeLorean.
Yeah.
So I apologize.
No,
I think it
no.
did it
well,
run on
is, like, a
did
lot
it
of...
run on plutonium. I think that's what they got from the people at the front there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the thing. It's like so many, like everybody's like conception of like how nuclear energy works comes from movies, and it's all very bad.
I'm finding this
very
out.
Inaccurate.
I'm finding this out.
Although I will shout out Canada. You guys can put sample like irradiation samples in your power reactors. CANDU reactors are very strange setups that are kind of sideways compared to the way like an American reactor is usually, and you can slide things in and out of them while they're running,
like a pizza oven.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like a lot of little tubes, and you can just, some of them you can slide things in and out of.
You know, and that I've talked to another another nuclear scientist, and I forget what year it was, but the CANDU reactors were shut down for maintenance, and then something broke. They couldn't get it back up and running, and literally Canada ran out of those radioactive isotopes for medicine.
Yeah,
like, it was just over so fast.
And it wasn't just Canada. That was like a fourth of the world supply.
Yeah. Oh, I remember this. It was a disaster. Like, it was a big deal.
And it coincided with the volcano that I am not going to attempt to pronounce in
Iceland.
Iceland. Yeah.
It was the same time. Eyjafjallajökull. I think that's how you pronounce it.
I'll go with it. Yeah. So it coincided with that, which meant we also couldn't ship in any of the isotopes produced in like Northern Europe, which is where a couple of the other production sites were.
That's right. I'm remembering this now. I'm sorry, I derailed our conversation.
That's part of why I work on like looking at radioisotope production, because we have to get better supplies for these. Because like, you know, with the space stuff, like I'm very passionate about like space and seeing what's out there, but like the medical stuff is urgent and important for people's immediate lives right now.
So you, with your dissertation, that's the idea you were talking about is making this plutonium, can you elaborate just a little bit more on that?
Yeah. Well, like basically when you have like these research reactors, there's basically what you're putting things in there to soak up the neutrons that are floating around.
Mm-hmm.
And depending on where you put it, you'll get different energy neutrons. Which have then different probabilities of causing different reactions. So where you put it and how long you put it there is really important.
Neutron is bonks into something, makes a new thing. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. It may bonk into it. It may bounce off. It may be absorbed in one type of and cause one type of reaction. Like, you know, it may be absorbed and then just give off a gamma ray. Or it may be absorbed and then spit right back out again. So, like, there's all these different interactions that can happen.
That's frustrating.
Yes. We have just... none of this is anything that we can model mathematically. We just have huge data tables of experimental data.
So, is it... is it random, then? You just, like, hope for the best? No way.
Well, we know the statistics of it.
Okay. Well, so
like, we know these probabilities.
Right. Yeah. It's more probable than others, but still... It's not like you can like always get this to happen every single time. And is that what you're kind of looking at?
Yeah, well, it's basically like if we know the like what neutrons we're expecting to get, we have ways of modeling it that are essentially just doing a bunch of dice rolls based on probability tables.
It's like Dungeons and Dragons.
It is exactly like that, except on a much larger scale.
Oh my goodness. So plus 7 to plutonium production.
Yeah. So like basically all we're doing, like we call them Monte Carlo codes. And that's pretty much the gold standard of what we do for modeling things is we run through these Monte Carlo codes.
Oh my God. I'm just smiling. I'm just smiling from ear to ear. This is just so fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. So we just have, you know, probability tables. Go with that.
Because if you can increase the probability just a little bit, that's profound in the entire industry.
Yeah, it can. And so like a lot of what like the nuclear industry is very, 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 very conservative in terms of trying new things, which is good in some ways because we have a lot of things that are safe and haven't broken yet. So we know they're safe,
yeah,
which is important. But also, we tend to kind of get stuck in ruts and not move on with it, like looking at better ways to do things. And so with a lot of like the way we look at isotope production, we're like, all right, well, we know generally if we design a target that looks like this, it'll work. And, you know, nothing's going to overheat anywhere. It'll be safe in a reactor. And so we just keep doing it that way. Mm-hmm. And some of it also just... like relies on someone who has institutional knowledge. They're like, all right, well, we've got this one dude that's been here for 30 years doing this, but what? Sometime he's going to retire.
And like, just Bill knows the magic to make it happen.
Yeah. So we can't like, we can't rely on that stuff. We need to actually have like, you know, built in ways of actually saying, all right, we have, you know, looked at this from all these different options of things that we can change to see what is actually the best option.
Gotcha. So instead of Bill's like, you know, if you put it in this sweet spot here at an 85 degree angle just right, you get a higher probability of whatever. You're like, okay, we need to data log this with.
Yeah. And part of that is for the longest time, we couldn't model, like we just couldn't do that amount of modeling because, you know, if you think about it, if you're having to get any kind of reasonably accurate statistics by rolling dice, you have to do a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
So to do our modeling, we are, you know, modeling millions and millions and millions and millions of particles. That is so much computing power.
Do you use like a neural network or like
there are people, there are a lot of people working on neural networks. I don't do a lot with that. But like mine is mostly, but they've got some newer codes, that aren't, they're not quite to the standard that you could use them to justify your safety analysis yet, but they run so much faster.
Right. They kind of teach themselves as they go, but then you're kind of sketched out if they're accurate or not.
Well, it's more that they're built on modern computing systems. Like the standard code has just been getting updated since the 50s.
Oh my goodness.
So we still,
the processing power is better, but the code is ancient.
Yeah. Well, and it just, we still refer to them as input decks, and each line of this text file is called a card.
Oh my goodness.
Because that's what they did. They just updated it so that it's now a text file input.
It's like a punch card from back in the day.
Oh yeah, well, that's goodness. That's where this code started. It was punch cards.
Wow. Wow. Oh man, just like with folks like you working on this in like 10, 20 years, there's a revolution coming, isn't there? That's like, I'm excited about this whole industry.
Yeah, well, and there's a lot of people also like that are really starting to push because, you know, like renewable energy is great, but you also need to have some level of baseline.
You do, yes.
And with nuclear, it's carbon. It does not have a carbon output.
Right. Yeah. Aside from the radioactive material, which has its drawbacks, it does not produce carbon dioxide.
Yeah. And there's a lot we can do that we aren't doing as far as waste goes. Like we are doing it very badly, especially in the US.
Yeah. Well, I'm the more I learn about this, like I'm definitely on the side of having nuclear as like the stopgap as fossil fuels are phased out. Right. Because you're right.
Yeah.
Alternative energy windmills and solar and things like that is intermittent, right? You do need like that on-demand power. So,
yeah. And there's a lot of stuff you can do where like, if you have a nuclear system set up when the renewables are really, really going, you can switch it to doing some other task.
Cool. Man, I'm just like, I just need a second here to collect myself.
Yeah.
This is absolutely fascinating. I'll just roll into my other question. Yeah. If some more stuff comes to me in my befuddled brain, I'll come back to it. One of the things that in your bio you mentioned is rocket science. So how does nuclear translate to rocket science?
Yeah, so there's two different ways that we use nuclear things in space. One is, so I mentioned earlier the radioisotopes that I work with. So a radioisotope thermoelectric generator, or an RTG, is the type of power unit that is used on like the rovers. It was used on New Horizons that went out to Pluto. And that is basically just a battery. It's just a toasty little piece of plutonium. And you can take that heat, you can use it to heat your spacecraft. You can use it to create some electricity using different power conversion options. And that's an ongoing bit of research right now also. And you can use it, and then with that, you can create propulsion using just a little electric propulsion system. That's not ideal for people. Like, it will run forever. Like, those are very long. That's why Voyager is still sending us information. Because those things just keep running. But they do not, like, you're not going to get much thrust out of that. So they're just going to go real slow, which is not ideal for humans in space.
Right, right. Like, okay, gotcha, yeah.
And then the other option is nuclear thermal propulsion. So with, like, a regular rocket, you have some sort of gas that's combusted. So you've created heat, and then you are taking that heated gas and expanding it through a nozzle. With nuclear thermal propulsion, what you can do is use a reactor to heat a propellant gas. Usually, like, the ideal would be hydrogen. And so like, it's not combusting or anything. You're just heating it up and then expanding it through a nozzle. So it's basically just how are you heating your gas?
Do you need less? So what's an advantage of that then?
One advantage is that hydrogen is very light compared to like fuel and oxygen.
Like solid fuel. Fuel is crazy heavy. Okay. Yeah.
So if you're just carrying, you know, your power source, like your core and a lot of hydrogen, that's much lighter. And then you have an alternative where, you know, some of the systems that I've looked at will also have an option where it's providing electricity for the spacecraft also.
Oh,
like you could have, you know, some channels for accelerating, you know, your propellant. You can have other channels that are just heating up, you know, something to create power.
Right. And then you don't need the super heavy batteries that some of those things have on them. Oh, you decrease and then you can carry more fuel, right? Yeah. Cause that's always the thing. It's a trade-off of whatever.
Yeah. Like, and with rockets, and this doesn't come up as often in chemical rockets because it's the same thing, but your fuel and your propellant aren't necessarily the same thing. So with nuclear thermal propulsion, your fuel would be like your uranium. That's what's creating your energy. But then you have the propellant, which would be your hydrogen.
Gotcha. And this is, okay, one of many follow-up questions. So this is, okay, I've heard people mention nuclear rockets before, and I just assumed it was like a giant bomb that blew up on the back and made it go. Is that a real thing?
Someone with that, I mean, it's not a thing. It's something that someone came up with at one point that comes up every now and again, but it's not something I don't think
it's not what you're talking about. Okay.
Looking at.
Right. Because it's like a crazy person came up with that. So,
Okay.
So what's stopping us from moving to that? Is it just like it works on paper, we haven't built it yet, or is it like the infrastructure to build it isn't there?
Politics.
Because nuclear is not quote unquote safe. Hmm.
Yeah, people, it scares people. And like, there's a lot of, you would have to build up some infrastructure. So the US did some testing and flew one nuclear thermal rocket in the 60s or 70s, I can't remember. And a lot of that testing, you couldn't do it the way they did it then.
Oh, okay.
They were like,
different standards.
They're like, all right, we need to see what happens when we put, you know, hydrogen through this nuclear reactor. Let's just vent it into the desert.
Exactly. Yeah. Or just outside of Las Vegas,
yep,
right?
Yep. So we don't do that anymore. And I think, Canada had one of the Russian ones come down over it.
Oh, probably.
Like one of the Russian NTPs came down over Canada.
Yeah, I think that was in the northern part of Canada.
Yeah.
It's just, there's not a whole lot of people that live up there.
Yeah, so. There was that at least.
Well, I guess it's like the middle of the desert. Not a whole lot of people live there either. But, huh. Okay, interesting. Well, thanks for talking about how nuclear energy and nuclear power relate to rocket science. It's cleared up a misconception that I've had, and it's cool. I have more of a framework now going forward. Thank you.
Yeah.
I wonder if people listening to this are like, what the heck? Just like me. I wonder if they're just sitting there going, whoa, I don't know.
Yeah. And I think, from what I remember, the Martian, most of the science there, apart from the windstorm on Mars, was good. As far as like a spacecraft design, that's pretty much what it would have to look like.
Yeah. Cause he kept himself warm because he had the spent fuel. Something there was radioactive.
But the actual ship that they used to get like to and from Mars.
Oh, okay.
Like that is something that like we have the technology that if someone decided to actually put the money towards it to do, we could do that.
Cool.
Like in the relatively near term.
Nice. Well, the SLS I was reading is close. That's like the two years away, right? The SLS thing when NASA's got
I haven't been following it closely.
Oh, I was shocked their time frame. I was like, boy, that's pretty. They have a mission to go around the moon in like 2 years or something like that. Or so. Anyways, I might have to fact check that, but I swear I read that. So,
yeah, I mean, with a lot of that, what we lost was just the infrastructure and, you know, those individual people who knew you know, bits and pieces of manufacturing something like the Saturn V. There was just like a loss of institutional knowledge when people retired.
All right, so this is going to be hard, right? We're going to talk about pets. we always ask our guests to share a pet story from their life because we mix science and animals on the podcast here. Do you have a pet story from your life you could share with us?
Sure. Right now I have two cats that I got when I started my master's degree. So actually the computer just reminded me that it was 14 years ago, I think 2 days ago, that I got Shadow. So I have a large black, he's part Maine Coon. So he's giant and fluffy.
Aw.
He's very bad at being a cat.
What does that mean?
He is not good at grooming himself. He falls off of things all the time.
He's klutzy.
Like, he can jump onto things, but getting down is a problem.
He's like the albatross on Rescuers. Yeah. Just crashes.
he really wants to go outside. But the one time he managed to get out of the house I was living in at the time and into the backyard, he made it like 5 feet out and then cried until I carried him inside.
Oh. It's just too big and scary out there.
He's just.
And what's your other cat's name?
She is Tilly. She's much more shy. Like, I got Shadow when he was tiny, but Tilly had been living at the Humane Society for about a year. And so was really nervous all the time. But she's mellowed out a lot and just mother's Shadow. So, you know, he's not good at grooming himself, but she picks up the slack.
Oh, that's adorable, though.
Yeah. And then she uses him for a blanket when it's cold, like, because, you know, they're both starting to get older now. And she's this just tiny little cat. And so she just gets cold all the time. And so, like, as soon as it hits fall, they sleep and she's just got her nose in his belly fur.
That was like when Beaker, our golden, was a little puppy. She would snuggle up into Bunsen's big bear fur.
Yeah, that's what they do.
That's cute. That's adorable.
So yeah, they started getting along immediately, which I was glad because it was the first time I'd had cats. So,
and Matt, I've been asking people, like, did you notice having pets during COVID in isolation, like, it helped your mental health?
Oh yeah, it would have been terrible without, because I live alone. So yeah, it's the cats, you know, gave me a little bit of structure of, you know, all right, I've got to go, you know, feed the cats, all that stuff.
When the isolation days blend in one into the other, hey?
Yeah.
What day is it? I don't know.
I don't know, but the cats have been fed, which means I should probably eat something.
There you go. Yeah. Cool. Shadow's obviously a black cat, right?
Yeah. And Tilly's gray.
Tilly's gray. Okay. Yeah. I apologize if you had already said that. So, oh, very cool. Now, what last question before we move on? Did Tilly come with the name Tilly, or did you name
Tilly? She did. Okay. She did. And I felt so bad. She apparently came with a sister that someone had already, like, adopted, which probably didn't help her isolation at the Humane Society.
Oh, they were probably buddies there.
Yeah. Yeah. Apparently there was Tilly and Millie.
Oh, that's cute. But you know what? That was such a great thing you did, giving that animal, that creature, a loving home. Like, you're an unsung hero for doing that for those pets. So
yeah, and Shadow was from someone had been doing a catch and release for feral cats, getting them fixed. And caught one, and she was pregnant, so he was part of that litter.
Oh, okay.
Which is why, like, I assume he's part Maine Coon, but no one really knows.
Do they do genetic testing for cats? I know that's a big thing with dogs.
I don't know. I don't care that much.
Yeah, I was going to say most people don't care about that with the cats.
he's a giant snow cat. I don't. he's clearly designed for snow.
Oh, I know about that with Bunsen. He is designed for the Arcticness of Alberta in the winter. I'll tell you that. thanks for sharing your pet story.
Yeah.
The other question we ask guests that's a really fun one is the super fact. And it's something that you know that when you tell people, it blows their minds. Now, like, I don't know if you've saved one behind because
I do.
I was just, my jaw was like, oh, this is too bad. This is an audio cast, because I was just like smiling, or my mouth was like, oh, like flies would go right in there. Do you have a super fact you could share with us?
I do. So here's something else that the movies have lied to you about.
No.
If a reactor is critical, it means it's on.
Not that it's going to melt down or something.
No, that means it's stable. If it's not critical, it's not going to be useful.
Oh, man.
If it's not critical, that means it's either shutting down or ramping up. But critical means it's balanced right there where it's operating at a stable power.
Do people tag along and get freaked out when there's like nuclear people using nuclear language and they're like, the nuclear the reactor's critical, and people are like, no, run.
I don't think so.
I'd imagine it would confuse some politicians who get like on tours, right?
We've had some interesting tours.
I see.
Yeah. But when that's one thing, you know, there are several research reactors that if people are curious that do tours like ours does at OSU, like, I mean, COVID aside,
right.
Under normal operation, like there's two in Oregon because there's us and then Reed College in Portland does tours.
Cool.
So, you know, if it's something you're curious about, look around. There's because like ours is also the Trigas especially are designed for like training. And so they tend to be a little bit less intense. Than like a larger scale reactor.
Right. They're not. Yeah. Okay. Gotcha. Yeah. It makes sense. Well, there you go. They call up your local nuclear research plant, folks. And it's an afternoon with the family. No, I'm just kidding. But if you go to a museum to learn something, I mean, you could go somewhere like that and learn that. That's interesting.
Yeah. Like we have like ours specifically, like we've got a little room set up with, you know, a couple different, like things you can look at. Like we've got a little Geiger counter and of course the orange Fiesta ware that every nuclear engineer tries to find at garage sales. And then it looks over our bay where you can see everything.
Oh, neat.
Yeah.
Well, that is a super fact. So if you hear somebody talking about a reactor being critical or going critical, it's all okay.
That is the ideal state.
Okay, cool. All right. you probably know, like I've talked to lots of people who are aerospace engineers or like they study exoplanets, and they know right away when a movie has hired like somebody who knows what they're doing. Because you probably noticed that too with, well, I don't know how much it happens with nuclear, but, I'd imagine many times you're like, no, that's wrong.
The Ghostbusters remake surprisingly correctly used the word supercritical, and I was very proud.
Oh, okay. but positrons don't react like that or something. There's something that,
there's a lot there, but they did use the word supercritical correctly.
That's so good. Yeah. I was gonna say, yeah, like they are fighting ghosts. So
yeah.
All right. The last question of our interview is another really fun one. It's the important to you section. It's outside of what you study. What do you do that you're passionate about? A cause or a hobby that you're really, really into? Or that you would like to tell people about. Do you have something there you could chat with us about?
Yeah. So as far as causes go, I do kind of a lot of advocacy, especially around like diversity and inclusion. And like, you know, my kind of pet areas are like LGBTQIA+ and disability issues. Because I'm a trans engineer, which is a rare thing and doesn't have a lot of representation anywhere. And then also disabled, like people are also, it's hard in engineering and academia. So,
Just with mobility or with other things as well.
It depends on what it is, like mobility, like even just like job, like accommodations, which, you know, are required by law, but that doesn't necessarily mean anything. Like I've had a supervisor that just started writing me up for being AWOL every time I got sick.
Oh.
Which led me, you know, here our graduate employees are unionized, and so I've been really involved with stuff with our union here.
Hmm. And when you've been involved with the LGBTQ organizations, like is there a specific one or are you just there as an advocate and is there anything more you would like to add there?
My most recent stuff has been working. I work with the American Nuclear Society's Diversity and Inclusion Committee.
Okay.
And, you know, a lot of that has just been, you know, being the squeaky wheel to get things updated and fixed. Like, there's no reason. Like, I don't know why we are requiring people to pick male or female for our membership info.
Oh, just it's like just silly things like that. Well, I don't know if that's silly. It's actually kind of serious, right? It's kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like, you know, just making people aware, like changing your name, like changing your last name when you get married is difficult. Changing your first name, they add even more roadblocks. And people just aren't aware of that because it's not something that comes up for most people. And so until you really think about it, you're like, oh, why is this so complicated? There's no reason for this.
Exactly. There's no reason. Like, I'm just trying to think of the teachers I work with who got married and, you know, took their husband's last name. Some of them did, some of them didn't. It was literally as easy in the workplace as changing their nameplate on the door. Yeah.
Usually there are extra hurdles if you change your first name.
Well, that's not fair.
Even for like, you know, changing your membership, like your rewards membership for some store. A lot of times they have a different process if you're changing your first name.
Oh, good grief. I didn't know that. That's frustrating.
Yeah. And so like, you know, a lot of what I do is just, I don't mind being the one that's being loud and obnoxious. So I'm like, I'll go do that until someone fixes something.
Oh, well, that's very admirable. That's you have to be brave to do that. Do you get some blowback occasionally for sticking your neck out like that? Or is it just like the voices need to be heard and everybody is okay with that?
I don't know that I've gotten like much.
I'm sorry, is this an awkward question? I'm sorry. No, I don't need to ask it. Okay.
It's not that there's been a lot of blowback. It's just people will agree with you that there's something that needs to change and then nothing changes. So it's frustrating. But like I haven't gotten like people saying, you know, you're a bad person. Like, you know, I haven't gotten like really negative like feedback or anything. It's just nothing changes.
What is that? Lip service, right? They pay you lip service and then back burner it. Well, that's important work. And you mentioned that your work has unionized. Is that atypical?
It's becoming more common. A lot more graduate employees, like this is like graduate research assistants, teaching assistants, sometimes fellows. Our fellows are not included in our bargaining unit, although it's something that we would like to change. but it's been so helpful having like, and I'm in engineering, so I am pretty well like supported. Like, you know, I get paid a lot more than the minimum salary. But, you know, if I can lend my weight to getting, you know, our graduate employees in like the humanities and the liberal arts to get enough to eat and pay rent, like I'm going to do that.
I see that on Twitter and it's heartbreaking. Like there's people that I follow, all these different scientists, social scientists and people in the humanities. Right. And
yeah,
they have chatted about that they sometimes have to make the decision to continue school or just survive. And that's a really unfortunate decision to have to make.
Yeah. And like, I hate that I make like more than twice what like friends in anthropology make. Like, I don't think that's fair. Mm-hmm. My work is not that much more valuable to anyone than theirs is. And like the thing that's been a game changer for me at this school specifically has been the health insurance that I get. It is the best health insurance I have ever had.
Instead of having to be I'm just trying to wrap my head because I'm Canadian, right? So you guys have you have to be check on the open market for insurance plans and whatnot.
Yeah, right? Like Oregon has a decent they took the expanded Medicaid option, and so like when I first moved to Oregon before I was a student, I was on the Oregon health plan, and theirs was pretty decent, but I also went through the open market in Georgia, which was horrendous. And like some graduate students,
I can't imagine.
Yeah. And like some graduate students can still be on their parents, but given that I'm, you know, coming back to this much older, I have well aged out of that.
Right. Yeah. So those are like, those two things are important and they're good work and they're somewhat serious. Do you have some, a fun hobby that you do?
I do. I'm actually really excited about this. I've been playing Dungeons & Dragons for almost 25 years now. And in July, I'm starting with a friend's streaming game. So that's going to be my first time streaming D&D.
So camera on you while you play campaigns?
They don't use cameras, but like audio, and then like you'll see like our map and everything.
What? For the characters. No way. How does that... like a rendition of the map, like a, or like an overhead of the map?
No, it's a computer generated map. Yeah, like we're all remote. So
right. Yeah. So I played a tiny bit of D&D, but I love the idea of D&D. Is there a particular character class that you like to play? Is that too tough of a question?
No, I tend to go towards Druid.
Druid. So that's the ones that can shapeshift, right? If I remember right.
Yep.
Cool.
Like you can shapeshift, you get some healing, and you can go a lot of different ways with it.
When I played, it was like in high school and everybody was terrible. So in order to keep everybody alive, I always had to be the healer, the cleric.
Yep.
I always had to be the cleric to keep everybody alive because everybody was trash. and I think the cleric can wear super, super heavy armor. So you can't fight well, but you just kind of stay alive and keep everybody else alive.
Yep. That's the point.
Is that it? Okay. And do you have a lot of fun with the people you're streaming with? Like, do you take on the personality of your characters and have a lot of like rat-a-tat back and forth?
It varies a little bit, you know, kind of depending on, you know, if you're saying something in character or if you're, you know, talking about a dice roll or something.
Right. Yeah, gotcha.
Less in character, but yeah.
I watched a hilarious YouTube video. It was about why everybody hates playing Dungeons & Dragons with the thief class. Because this, I don't know if you've seen that, but it's hilarious. The thief is always like trying to bend the rules and not paying attention and trying to backstab everybody when there's no shadows to hide in. And they're just being generally a frustrating character to have in your party. So,
but they're worth it when they get to roll that critical hit and it's like 80,000 six-sided dice.
Yeah. When they get it to work, it's like a glass cannon, right? Like
yep.
High risk, high reward. Well, that's cool. Hey, could you send me a link when you start streaming? I'd like to check that out. Awesome.
I mean, I can go ahead and give you the link. He's got a Twitch channel, so.
Oh, okay. Would you like that in the show notes? We could put that.
Yeah, if you could.
Sure. What is it? Just go ahead and give it to us. So we're at the end of our interview. Thank you so much for chatting with us today, Emery. Man, I could probably talk to you for another hour. But that's not fair to you. Do you have a social media channel, social media account people can follow?
Yeah. You can find me on Twitter at Nuclear Alchemy.
Oh, cool. Nuclear Alchemy. I love it. and just Twitter, or do you have any other social media accounts?
That's really the only thing that I do. That's the one.
Perfect. We'll make sure that's in the show notes as well. So, everybody is just one click away from following you.
Awesome.
I was just so privileged to talk to you today. Thank you for giving up your time to chat.
Yeah, it was fun.
Oh, yay. I'm glad it was fun and not a drudgery.
Yeah, no, I enjoyed it.
Awesome. Okay, take care of yourself and have a great day.
You too.
It's time for Woo or Wow on the Science Podcast, and I have Adam and Chris as the contestants today. How are you doing today, guys?
I'm doing pretty good, feeling like winning.
I feel like super awesome. Winner, winner, chicken dinner. But let's not gloat.
Okay, so this week's category is nuclear science. How much do you guys know about nuclear science, nuclear engineering, nuclear power, nuclear weapons?
I've watched a couple 15-minute videos about nuclear power, so no, I know just about everything about nuclear power.
I know what we teach in grade 9 science.
Okay, War Wow works this way. I read 3 statements. 2 of them are fake. 1 of them is true. And my contestants have to try and figure out the true statement. All right, you guys ready?
Yeah.
All right, statement number 1. More than half of the energy in the United States comes from nuclear power. Statement 2. If you're exposed to nuclear radiation, quickly take iodine pills, as the tablets absorb up to 90% of the radiation coming at you. Statement 3. The former Soviet Union was the first world power to use nuclear energy to make electrical power. What do you guys think? We've got United States power exposed to nuclear radiation, and the former Soviet Union was the first power to use nuclear energy for electricity.
Okay, so I know that half of the energy in the U.S. is not made by nuclear power. That's just obvious. It's actually gone down recently. The amount of nuclear power used in the U.S. is because everyone's scared of nuclear power, you know? Lots of crap has happened with it that's not too great. Like, lots of things have blown up and people are kind of scared to make new ones. But I know it's definitely not half of the energy is made by nuclear power.
Okay, Adam, what do you think about these iodine tablets?
I don't think the iodine tablets will stop the radiation. It won't take up half of 90% of the radiation, because if so, then all of the guys with the Dragon Core incident would have still been alive. Because they just dropped, like, what they did was they made the core go supercritical and make it go crazy. So if the iodine pills were true, they would have taken the iodine pills and they probably would have been okay. So, I mean, I don't think the iodine pills is correct.
Okay. And then the former Soviet Union. So Chernobyl is over in that area of the world.
Yeah, but Chernobyl wasn't the first, nuclear power plant. It was the first nuclear power plant to really go crazy and have everyone know about it today. Like, you say Chernobyl to someone and they know exactly what it is, which is why I don't think that in the U.S. 50% of energy is nuclear.
Okay, so what are you guys going with? Statement one, statement two, or statement three is true?
I'll go with statement three because it makes a bit of sense.
So you're going with the former USSR?
Yep.
Being the first, was it, what was it?
The first world power to use nuclear energy to make electricity.
I'm saying no, I'm not going for that one.
Okay.
You know what? I'm going to disagree with Adam and I'm going to say, well, you know, Jason always punches the numbers. He'll be like, oh, haha, it was really one quarter instead of one half. But I'm going to say more than half of the U.S.'s energy comes from nuclear energy sources.
All right, so that means you both think the iodine tablet one is a little bit fishy, and you're right. Iodine tablets can help with radiation poisoning, but if you're exposed to radiation, you're supposed to take all your clothes off because your clothes contain 90% of the radiation. That's why if you've seen any of those dramatizations of Chernobyl, they had the people stripped down to their undies, and maybe not even that. So we're down to two statements. The first statement's about the percent of power used in the United States, and the third statement is who got to use nuclear power for electricity first. All right, so which one do you want to hear first, Adam?
I want to hear mine first, because I think Mom's going to be a bit stubborn on who she wants to hear first. So we'll go with mine first.
All right, the former Soviet Union was the first world power to use nuclear energy to produce electrical energy is correct. So that means Adam wins. The Obninsk power plant came online in 1954, which means that Chris, yours is wrong. It's only 20% of the power, not 50.
Oh, see, he just fudges those numbers. That's the clue. That's the clue. You think, is there a number in there? Then it's probably woo.
All right. Good job, Adam. Congratulations.
Yay.
All right.
Okay. It's time for story time with me, Adam. If you don't know what story time is when we talk about stories that have happened within the past 1 or 2 weeks, but this one's special. We've got Duncan here, and he's got a new addition to the doggies. The fur family.
Yeah, so his name is George. He is a beautiful white cat. I'd say he's roughly 2 years old-ish, and he's been a very good kitty cat. His origin story is kind of interesting because he showed up at the best possible time, which was when I was moving addresses. Which was fantastic. Not only do I have to pay attention to where all my stuff went, now I got to pay attention to where this cat is. Needless to say, he adjusted quite well. He was able to kind of nestle into the little nooks and crannies as we moved. And then once he made the transition to the new address, he adjusted quite nicely. It took him a few days to explore the place, but once he did, he felt right at home. And he's been a very good cat. He also likes to go outside for walks. And by walks, I mean he walks to a spot and then stands there and sniffs around and then moves to another spot. My walks rarely go more than 30 feet away from the house. But overall, very good kitty cat. His other favorite activity is hunting flies. So, in the event that an intruder enters the fatherland, he comes in to defend it. And he's gotten pretty good. He's starting to get some airtime now. But yeah, that's George, the basic synopsis. His last name is Tank Missile.
George Tank Missile.
Yeah, George Tank Missile.
All right, so I have a bit of a story about George. When George got... Did we talk about if he got fixed?
Yeah.
All right, fine. So when George got fixed, he had to go in the vet in a little crate-y crate. He didn't like it. He didn't like being in the crate really all that much. He was kind of cry-y because he's a cat and cats aren't supposed to be in cages. But when he got fixed and when we were taking him back, he decided to do front flips in the crate. And I almost dropped him like four separate times because he kept on like flipping it around and doing Cirque du Soleil inside of the crate.
What? George is a bit of a goofball, I will say.
I have not been part of any of this.
Yeah, apparently when George came to after the procedure, the vet described him full of life and not willing to wear the cone. It was a bit of an arduous couple weeks.
All right, Mom, do you have a story about George?
I sure do. I actually could talk about George all day. I've spent a little bit of time with him, and he is a really precious cat. To tag on the story about the vet, the technician called and said, George is ready to be picked up, but he has been able to acrobat his way out of the cone.
Yeah, I had to be physically tied to him.
Yeah, they put the gauze around his neck and then under his belly and made a makeshift harness to hold the cone on. But every time I go over and say hi to George, he always comes over and he purrs and he's like likes to smell my feet for some weird reason. And but what we did is I picked up cat house for George, and because Duncan wanted him to sit by the window and be able to look out.
Yeah, and have like a little spot you can call his, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and he has a little scratch post on it and a little toy to play with. So that's my story. He went immediately to it and jumped up, and I guess he spends most of his day in his cat house as the king of the king of the house. So that's my story about George. He's a precious, precious cat that is a new addition to, an extended addition to our family.
Yeah, George is a good cat. Came from, came from nowhere, and then
now he's here.
And now he's here.
All right, so that is story time today. Hope to catch you guys next week on the podcast. Bye-bye.
That's for then, yeah.
That's the end of another podcast episode. Thanks for coming back week after week. Special thanks to our expert, Emery Colvin, who talked to us about nuclear engineering. And we'd also like to give a special shout out to our top tier patrons on Patreon. Without their help, our show wouldn't be what it is today. Take it away, Chris.
Samantha Dodd, Kimberly Bond, Nate Stevenson, Debbie Anderson, Courtney Proven, Renee Hardy, Mary Rader, Shelby Leggett, Dan Fry, Mary Coos, Katla Lynch, Marianne McNally, Andrea Persons, Elizabeth Bourgeois, Karen Beth St. George, Bianca Hyde, Lynn Armstrong, Lisa Swartz, Catherine Jordan, Donna Craig, Lila Ashier, Jody Ogren, Liz Button, Kathy Zerker, and Ben Rathert.
Let's close with the dog's motto: for science, empathy, and cuteness.